diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive. This.
Oh God, no, no, it's not. Or maybe. Oh,
no!
Oh, no!
Oh my God!
There it is. Are you okay?
Yeah.
It's gone.
No, it's
hold not. On, is it coming back?
Yeah!
Yeah! Yeah. Come explore
the animal queendom.
Come explore the animal queendom. Okay, this is Jesse. I'm with some of the Canada Land team in New York City, in Times Square, at the epicenter of mass media. And our podcast was just on a huge, obnoxious, honking trillion pixel wraparound building size digital billboard for our new show, A Field Guide to Gay Animals. Our new podcast was just on that billboard after Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, new Bad Boys movie. How did that happen? We did not spend any money for that, I assure you. We were selected because they do this like hot new podcast thing here, and our new podcast about gay animals was selected to run in Times Square. It's a great show, but I think that we got up there not just because it's a great show. I think that we just got lucky. It's suddenly so topical. We didn't know it was going to be topical. We chose to start making this podcast months and months ago. But then a bunch of stuff happened. I don't know. There was a TV show also about gay animals, and the right wing went nuts, like Alex Jones and Fox News and the New York Press. They all started to express a lot of concern and worry that maybe the media is trying to convince kids that queerness is normal and natural, and that must be resisted. And Alex Jones went on this lunatic rant about how, like, yes, there may be queer frogs, but that's just because the Pentagon is putting chemicals in the water to turn them queer. And then in March, the first record of humpback whales fucking was recorded, and it was two male whales. So everybody's talking about gay animals all of a sudden, and I guess we're just riding that wave. And that's what's put our podcast here on the billboard at Times Square. I'm obviously very excited about this, but I don't want to get too excited because I think that, you know, the way that these cultural trends work and controversy works is, like, it's because there's another pressure. It's that right-wing pressure against gay rights. And it's not just silly stuff like Alex Jones. The ACLU says that there are 516 bills this year, some proposed, some defeated, and some of them passed into law that are pushing back queer rights in the states, like forced outing of kids in schools or censoring curriculum that teaches kids about gay people, the don't say gay laws in Florida. Stuff like that is happening again and again. And in Canada, we're starting to see it too. There was a proposed book ban in Manitoba to stop kids from learning about queer stuff and sex ed class. Most notably, there is like a forced outing law that's in effect in New Brunswick. The Minister of Education has said that teachers are not allowed to use a kid's chosen pronouns or name unless the parents know about it and approve, which in effect forces kids to out themselves to their parents if they don't want to be misgendered at school. And Poilievre says that's fine. Like, if the provinces want to do that, he's not going to do anything about it if he becomes prime minister. You can see the wider trend where this is going. And so that's why I think we're suddenly looking at the animal kingdom and having these debates, because, you know, what we're really talking about here is what is normal, what is natural, and what is, I don't know, deviant or decadent or debased behavior. And animals have a lot of credibility when it comes to determining what's natural. They don't tweet much because they're having sex. They're involved in unmentionable bestial acts. And yeah, today we're going to mention those bestial acts. Listen, if all you know about gay animals is from that children's book, Tango Makes Three, if all you know are like the nice penguin dads from the Central Park Zoo, you might be a little scandalized by today's episode. I am going to talk to our newest podcast hosts, Owen Ever and Lane Kaplan-Levinson, the hosts of our field guide to gay animals. We're going to talk about Wuzzling, Rumpy Pumpy, and Hooligan Cocks. Send the kids away. Call them near. It's your call. Wait for it.
Seriously.
Should we find the penguins?
Penguins and seabirds. Perfect.
Wow.
Okay, wow. The smell. Do you smell that? It's so strong.
It's like putrid and also delicious.
Yeah.
We're all doing so many little things. There's little guys lying down. Their wings spread. They're stretching. Flapping their tails.
Having quiet conversations. It feels very Victorian, making eyes at each other. Let me challenge you. Take a look at these penguins. Can you tell me which ones are straight, which ones are gay, which ones are male, which ones are female? You can't.
Well, that one looking off to the side.
Okay,
like,
well,
that one's gay.
Obviously. Yeah, except for that twink. But the thing is...
For the most part, no.
No. You've heard of Roy and Silo?
I have heard of Roy and Silo. This is the penguins from the zoo that we're at right now, Central Park Zoo.
Yes, they lived right here. Roy and Silo lived right here. They were together for, I think, 5 years, these two male penguins. And then in 2004, the New York Times published an article about animal homosexuality writ large, but sort of the hero animals in that story were Roy and Silo, the gay penguins.
Right, and then just because of all of that for so long, penguins became... for one reason or another, for better or worse, like the animal that people knew about if they knew about gay animals, right? It was like, oh, have you heard about the gay penguins?
Yeah.
Like, did you know that there could be animals that are gay?
I'm Owen Ever, co-host of A Field Guide to Gay Animals.
I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and I'm also a co-host of A Field Guide to Gay Animals.
I remember reading to my kids this very popular book that was going around at the time, where you teach your kids, hey, here's a story of the two daddy penguins in the Central Park Zoo, based on a true story. See? It's natural for penguins to be just like straight couples, even when they're both guy penguins. That's what we were telling our kids, and that's what that book was saying, was you don't have to hate gay men because they have families.
Yeah.
And raise kids.
They have the capacity to be respectable, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and this was, I guess, for its time, a progressive idea. Mm-hmm. I am aware that the kind of animal sex that is discussed on your show is very different than
right.
the two daddy penguins and their adopted penguin chick.
Yes, the book is beautiful and accessible and, dare I say it, rather milquetoast. And yet, it has been in litigation. It has been banned every year since publication. This book is considered to be too extreme. When it comes to penguins, like, that has sort of always been the case. We've always tried to lift penguins up as like this respectable form of animal. If we are going to perceive animals as having any likeness to us, we're going to pick these true freaks because, I don't know, they look like they're wearing suits. But going all the way back to George Murray Levick in the 19th century, observing homosexual behavior among, quote, hooligan, and then deciding to write all of his field notes in secret code so that no one would have to read it and be offended by what was being observed. He wanted to avoid the scandal of that. So the closeting of penguins has always sort of coincided with us trying to hold them on a pedestal as an example of respectability. They're penguins. They're penguins.
We have to pause here for a few reasons. Don't put your penguin on a pedestal. Yeah, so a is a male penguin?
Is a male penguin, yes.
Okay, because that is now the name of my punk band. That is amazing. What kind of queer animal sex actually takes place out there in the wild? Greatest hits.
So get ready to have some new like Pornhub search terms, because we're going to talk about goosing, wuzzles, rump sniffing. But yeah, one of my favorites, goosing. Okay. So this is something that I have to admit that I am terribly jealous of. Maybe I'll describe the act and you can guess what creature does this. But it has been documented specifically as a male-male sexual behavior in which one creature takes his beak and sticks it into the genital slit of the other and then blows bubbles, whistles, makes vibrational sounds, and, this is going to give it away, pushes his partner through the ocean. Do you know what charismatic creature in the ocean I'm talking about?
You're asking me?
I'm asking you.
What animal propulses its sexual partner through the ocean by sticking its nose in the partner's genital slit? A jellyfish.
Oh my goodness, that would be amazing. It's a dolphin. It's a bottlenose dolphin.
Okay, let's hear a little bit from Field Guide to Gay Animals.
This is Janet Mann.
I'm a distinguished university professor at Georgetown University in the departments of biology and psychology.
Out on the water, the team conducted frequent surveys of all the daily observable activities, like foraging, and occasionally the calves doing their cute little things like chasing seaweed. Pretty G-rated stuff, except not really.
Because the dolphins do have a high rate of sexual interactions, but it's largely the juvenile animals and even the calves get involved in these polyadic, like, sexual interactions, sometimes involving, you know, 11 or 12 individuals.
So one day, the team is out there on the boat, not too far from the shoreline, and Janet's doing her routine observations, calling out every activity she sees so that they can be recorded by her colleagues.
Shave goes on side. Cookie swims over to Shave.
As the boys go about their afternoon shenanigans, Janet, like a seasoned sportscaster, continues to announce,
Cookie mounts Shave, Cookie mounts Shave. Wave goes on side, Cookie mounts Wave again, Cookie mounts Wave again.
Meanwhile, a large crowd of tourists gathers on the shore.
My voice was carrying really well across the water. Cookie face slaps. Cookie has an erection. Wave has an erection. Shave has an erection. Cookie rubs penis on Shave. And then I sort of looked up. I realized everybody was watching and they saw me watching them. And then like they started clapping.
Oh my God, dolphins are so gay. I mean, obviously the goosing is a big one. Something that I love about dolphins is they kind of run the gamut of like, you know, you can fit them into this like heteronormative monogamous structure. They like can mate with each other for decades. Like we learned about this couple, Cookie and Smokey, that have been together for literally like 40 years. And so that can make people be like, oh, that's so cute. You know, like they mate for life. And then also they have like wild orgies and are super polyamorous. Stuff that the people reading Tango Make 3 would not want to hear about.
It's a very open relationship. They check in.
Yeah, literally, like, the biologist that we talked to after, like, she was using different words for it, but it was, like, they actually perform, like, aftercare. Like, after these orgies, they'll go back to their partners and be like, how are you doing? Was that okay? Like, what do you need?
They'll pet each other. They'll feed each other. They'll be tender to each other.
Oh, my God. Oh. Let's go to land. What happens on land?
Bonobos have quite a reputation for being really gay, for being these kind of like free-loving hippies, for, you know, using sex for all different types of reasons beyond just procreating, like using sex for, you know, because they like it, having sex because it feels good, having sex also to do things like relieve tension in their societies, like if things are getting aggressive, if fights are about to break out, like what do? They have sex. Something that we learned that I really love is specifically this lesbian sex act, which kind of reminds me of like when you have these like wheelbarrow races. That's kind of what it is like if you describe it.
I was wondering where you were going with that.
Where like one bonobo will like female bonobo will like take her partner and like wrap her legs around her waist and literally also like carry her and like walk her around, and they'll be like clitoris to clitoris and stimulate each other's clitorises while thrusting in opposite directions, while like literally wheelbarrow style, and be like thrusting at a rate. Just, I mean, it's very fast, but imagine kind of like a wheelbarrow race, but it's sex and it's bonobos and it's lesbians.
And when bonobos, specifically when they meet another faction of bonobos, rather than, I don't know, sit down and draw the terms of the territory or fight, they all f*** together. They f*** and they eat. Like, imagine that in a boardroom. Imagine that during a merger. Imagine that in the middle of traffic. Like, society could be structured so much differently. That's all I'm saying, folks.
This is the kind of thing that is now fodder for Fox News. It's sort of this rage bait of, can you believe what they're trying to teach kids? Can you believe that they're making these shows trying to tell us about queerness in the animal kingdom? It sort of like feels like it's very much a part of the current culture wars right now. But there is a long history to the study of this topic and to the controversy and the attempts to suppress this topic. And as I understand it, it started in British Columbia?
Well, certainly our interest in this topic has its roots firmly planted in British Columbia. There's a book that we adore called Biological Exuberance. And this book was written by Bruce Bagamell, PhD. He was teaching at the University of British Columbia, zoology, linguistics, and ethnomusicology, a bit of a jack of all trades. And he published this book in 1999. It is a vast compendium indexing 450 species of animals that exhibit same-sex sexual behavior, partnership, courting, mating, a whole spectrum of behavior. And what's interesting about that is he points to the fact that these behaviors have not only been occurring, but have been observed for centuries.
In order for Bruce to have been able to publish a book like this in 1999, he was only able to do that by doing research based off of findings and publications that had been done for years and decades and centuries beforehand, which goes to show that, you know, the study and field of homosexual behavior in mammals and animals and species, you know, in non-humans had been documented for a long, 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 long time. And as you're saying, Jesse, of course, there had been backlash against that, you know, before last week.
What was also documented was the fear of that, how destabilizing that was, how threatening that was, the homophobic reactions. Whether willingly or not, these scientists, these journalists, the people that he was reading in order to make his book were showing their cards. They were showing their sort of their moral anxieties when it came to discussing animal homosexuality.
I mean, I can understand why, because the opposition to queerness is rooted, as I understand it, in this kind of accusation that this is against the natural order, whether it's kind of like some sort of biblical, this is an abomination, or whether you're trying to root it in some kind of Darwinian idea of like, sex is for procreation, that's not normal, it's not natural, to have someone say, actually, if you spend any time with animals, it's totally normal and natural. That threatens the entire foundation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, nature is so frequently weaponized against queer people in exactly the way that you're describing. The whole concept of crimes against nature goes back centuries. This idea that, like, since Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, and everyone latched on to the idea that the only purpose, the true singular imperative of life on Earth is reproduction, people have started to define everything else as aberrant, and that includes queerness. Though that is not the only thing Darwin was talking about, and obviously queerness goes back to the dawn of time. Like, there have always been non-reproductive activity happening in the animal kingdom as long as it has existed. And that's one of the fundamental things about Bruce's book. He proposes something that challenges this dominant order that is perpetually being weaponized against us.
I love that just the title itself, just it's almost like suggests a way to think of it. It's biological exuberance. It's just about the plenty. It's not constrained in the way that we've kind of understood it. And the way you're describing it to me, it sounds like this was not a book that said, hey, guess what? Animals are gay. It was like, hey, guess what? Animals are gay. And also that has been hidden for a long, long time.
Yes. And to just add to that and kind of connecting to what we've been starting to say, it's like, hey, guess what? Animals are gay. Hey, guess what? That's been hidden for a long time. And what happens when you start looking at the world in this more abundant, more exuberant way? What happens when you start to see things differently than how we've actually been told to see them? You know, something changes. And that's a type of worldview that I think Bruce was trying to show, because the book isn't just this, you know, straight up strict indexing of the 450 species that he documents in the book, which of course now many, many, many hundreds of more species have been documented. Over 1,500 species have been documented because the book was written, you know, 25 years ago.
And you said a really great word, Jesse, which is abundance. That is a word that he brings up a lot and is foundational to his new world view that he's proposing, to this new paradigm that he writes about. He proposes that the way that we've thought about the world is one of scarcity and therefore of competition and therefore about survival and individualism. And that's such, I mean, I'm in America. That is deeply embedded in us as Americans, that it's like there's only so much and only the top competitor will get it. And what he's saying is the world is actually about abundance. Things like queerness are not an extravagant waste. This is not an inefficiency of design. This is in fact part of the design, which threatens everything. When you're a mammalogist, when you're an evolutionary biologist, and you're like, but everything points back to the theory of evolution and reproduction moving forward. And then we have this notably gay scientist in the 90s telling us that not only are animals queer, despite centuries of us trying to closet that fact, not only are they queer, but they teach us a new way of looking at the world. That's threatening. And we got so excited about the proposal that he brought forward, but also how did this man, Bruce Bagamil, come to that conclusion? He published this book when he was 36, and he worked on it for 10 years prior to that. What set him up on this quest, this like, to make this magnum opus and publish this book? And then what were the repercussions for him? What happened?
Well, did you ask him?
The short answer is no. We don't know where he is.
Bruce Bagamil disappeared?
Yeah.
Can you tell me the story of the hunt for this author? Like, why were you looking for him? And like, where do you think he went and why?
As part of our ongoing quest to try to find out, we also spoke to a Canadian author, researcher, scholar, Kate Sandilands, who proposed that Bagamil, this curious last name that we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to pronounce, is in fact not his real name, that it is actually a nom de plume, that it is a pen name that he used. What's curious about that, he, in one interview immediately following the publication, does speak to this, saying that Bagamil comes from an old Slavic and Bulgarian word, Bogomite. It was a heretical group that practiced veganism or vegetarianism and excessive homosexuality. And he was like, these are two things that I ascribe to. And so therefore it is an appropriate name. I've reached out to the university in British Columbia and got nothing back. And so I don't even know if he was employed there under the name Bagamil. You know, this is also something that happens within, you know, queer life. You take on a name that is more aspirational. He wanted to be a vegetarian homosexual. And so he picked a name that spoke to that. That's another mystery that we have been following as well.
When you follow those threads of these associates or colleagues, the people thanked in the book, did that lead anywhere?
I mean...
dramatic pause, because our investigation just continued to present more elusiveness. We continued to find people who were like, the last I spoke to him, it was over an email. And it seems like there is a sort of like grand disappearance. And again, you know, we are still continuing. So hopefully more will come out and, you know, more can be revealed in the podcast and more can be revealed in further seasons.
Can I ask you, why was it so important to you both? Like, the idea is you have the book, you have this sort of gift to science, gift to writing, gift to thought, and it seems like this has led to a lot of exploration. People have picked up on this work. So much of what you look at in the show is about kind of continuing on that tradition. Why was it so important to know what happened to this person, to try to meet this person?
Like, we don't know why he did it, really. We can speculate. We can talk about, you know, the timing. We can talk about this being within the context of the AIDS crisis and his own identity as a homosexual. But this is us thinking about all of these things and not hearing directly from him. So what would it mean to hear directly from him? And also to think about, like, what he was planning, the books that he was planning to write. He was planning to write more books. Those books never came to fruition. What happened? To be able to have him, like, surface and to say, like, hey, what's been going on, you know, to actually like have that happen, that would be such an incredible, this is the dog, by the way, I'm dog sitting and there's an old dog named Jerry that's making himself known, but like, I mean, Jerry's like, by the way, I know Bruce and like,
yeah, Jerry's like, are we talking about respecting elders?
Jerry's like, Bruce emailed me like 5 minutes ago. But like, that would just be such an incredible opportunity. You know, that would it would be so magical.
Lane, Owen, thank you for making my very favorite new podcast. Thank you for talking with me about it.
Thanks so much for having us. This was really so fun.
Yeah, we love these deep dives that get into orgies and philosophy.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Tristan Capicchione is our audio producer and editor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I'm Justin Ling, filling in this week for Jesse Brown, who is off hunting his nemesis, a giant whale. And my guest is Paul McLeod, the senior correspondent for the Capital Forum. Paul McLeod, hello. What the hell is the Capital Forum?
We're an antitrust publication in Washington, D.C. Justin, I was so happy to get this call. I can only assume this means after years of talking about it, you finally did it. You finally killed Jesse Brown and took his hosting seat.
No, I clearly said at the top of the show, he's off hunting his nemesis, a giant whale, and that is a story I'm sticking to, no matter who asks.
So he's still out there.
Anyway, this week on the show, Papa Google gives Canadian media its $100 million allowance. But first, we need to impress our new babysitters. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Breaking news. CTV News has learned the federal government and Google have come to an agreement over the controversial Online News Act.
Google will be compensating our news organization with $100 million annually.
For work that's shared or repurposed on their platforms.
Smaller news outlets also have a seat at the negotiating table with the tech giants.
Meta, meanwhile, says, unlike search engines, we do not proactively pull news from the internet.